what Gia said, he hesitated, about you getting off this island, would you want to try it? She scowled. What do you mean? Well, I'm not saying it would be fun having you along, always complaining and glaring at me and stuff, but I suppose I could stand it if you wanted to try. Her expression softened just a little. How noble, she muttered. But no, Leo. If I tried to come with you, your tiny chance of escape would be no chance at all. The gods have placed ancient magic on this island to keep me here. A hero can leave. I cannot. The most important thing is getting you free so you can stop Gia. Not that I care what happens to you, she added quickly. But the world's fate is at stake. Why would you care about that? He asked. I mean, after being away from the world for so long. She arched her eyebrows, as if surprised that he'd asked a sensible question. I suppose I don't like being told what to do, by Gia or anyone else. As much as I hate the gods sometimes, over the past 3 millennia, I've come to see that they're better than the Titans. They're definitely better than the giants. At least the gods kept in touch. Hermes has always been kind to me. And your father, Hephaestus, has often visited. He is a good person. Leo wasn't sure what to make of her faraway tone. She almost sounded like she was pondering his worth, not his dad's. She reached out and closed his mouth. He hadn't realized it was hanging open. Now, Calypso said. How can I help? Oh. He stared down at his project, but when he spoke, he blurted out an idea that had been forming ever since Calypso made his new clothes. You know that flame-proof cloth? You think you could make me a little bag of that fabric? He described the dimensions. Calypso waved her hand impatiently. That will only take minutes. Will it help on your quest? Yeah, it might save a life. And, could you chip off a little piece of crystal from your cave? I don't need much. She frowned. That's an odd request. Humor me. All right, consider it done. I'll make the fireproof pouch tonight at the loom, when I've cleaned up. But what can I do now, while my hands are dirty? She held up her calloused, grimy fingers. Leo couldn't help thinking there was nothing hotter than a girl who didn't mind getting her hands dirty. But of course, that was just a general comment. Didn't apply to Calypso, obviously. Well, he said, you could twist some more bronze coils, but that's kind of specialized. She pushed in next to him on the bench and began to work, her hands braiding the bronze wiring faster than he could have. Just like weaving, she said. This isn't so hard. Huh, Leo said. Well, if you ever get off this island and want a job, let me know. You're not a total klutz. She smirked. A job, eh? Making things in your forge? Nah, we could start our own shop, Leo said, surprising himself. Starting a machine shop had always been one of his dreams, but he'd never told anyone about it. Leo and Calypso's Garage, auto repair and mechanical monsters. Fresh fruits and vegetables, Calypso offered. Cider and stew, Leo added. We could even provide entertainment. You could sing, and I could, like, randomly burst into flames. Calypso laughed, a clear, happy sound that made Leo's heart go kabump. See? He said. I'm funny. She managed to kill her smile. You are not funny. Now get back to work, or no cider and stew. Yes, ma'am, he said, They worked in silence, side by side, for the rest of the afternoon. Two nights later, the guidance console was finished. Leo and Calypso sat on the beach, near the spot where Leo had destroyed the dining table, and they ate a picnic dinner together. The full moon turned the waves to silver. Their campfire sent orange sparks into the sky. Calypso wore a fresh white shirt and her jeans, which she'd apparently decided to live in. Behind them in the dunes, the supplies were carefully packed and ready to go. "All we need now is a boat," Calypso said. Leo nodded. He tried not to linger on the word "we." Calypso had made it clear she wasn't going. "I can start chopping wood into boards tomorrow," Leo said. "Few days, we'll have enough for a small hole." "You've made a ship before," Calypso remembered. "Your Argo II." Leo nodded. He thought about all those months he'd spent creating the Argo II. Somehow, making a boat to sail from Ogygia seemed like a more daunting task. "So how long until you sail?" Calypso's tone was light, but she didn't meet his eyes. "Not sure. Another week?" For some reason, saying that made Leo feel less agitated. When he had gotten here, he couldn't wait to leave. Now, he was glad he had a few more days. Weird. Calypso ran her fingers across the completed circuit board. "This took so long to make." "You can't rush perfection." A smile tugged at the edge of her mouth. "Yes, but will it work?" "Getting out, no problem," Leo said. "But to get back, I'll need Festus and..."
"What?"
Leo blinked. "Festus, my bronze dragon. Once I figure out how to rebuild him, I'll..."
"You told me about Festus," Calypso said. "But what do you mean, get back?"
Leo grinned nervously.
"Well, to get back here, duh."
"I'm sure I said that."
"You most definitely did not."
"I'm not going to leave you here. After you help me and everything, of course I'm coming back. Once I rebuild Festus, he'll be able to handle an improved guidance system. There's this astrolabe that
He stopped, deciding it was best not to mention that it had been built by one of Calypso's old flames. "That I found in Bologna. Anyway, I think with that crystal you gave me..."
"You can't come back," Calypso insisted. Leo's heart went clunk.
"Because I'm not welcome?"
"Because you can't. It's impossible. No man finds Ogygia twice. That is the rule."
Leo rolled his eyes.
"Yeah, well, you might have noticed I'm not good at following rules. I'm coming back here with my dragon, and we'll spring you. Take you wherever you want to go. It's only fair."
"Fair."
Calypso's voice was barely audible. In the firelight, her eyes looked so sad Leo couldn't stand it. Did she think he was lying to her just to make her feel better? He considered it a given that he would come back and free her from this island. How could he not?
"You didn't really think I could start Leo and Calypso's auto repair without Calypso, did you?" he asked.
"I can't make cider and stew, and I sure can't sing."
She stared at the sand.
"Well, anyway," Leo said, "tomorrow I'll start on the lumber, and in a few days..."
He looked out over the water. Something was bobbing on the waves. Leo watched in disbelief as a large wooden raft floated in on the tide and slid to a stop on the beach.
Leo was too dazed to move, but Calypso sprang to her feet.
"Hurry!"
She sprinted across the beach, grabbed some supply bags, and ran them to the raft.
"I don't know how long it will stay."
But...
Leo stood. His legs felt like they'd turned to rock. He had just convinced himself he had another week on Ogygia. Now, he didn't have time to finish dinner.
That's the magic raft?
Duh, Calypso yelled. It might work like it's supposed to and take you where you want to go. But we can't be sure. The island's magic is obviously unstable. You must rig up your guidance device to navigate.
She snatched up the console and ran toward the raft, which got Leo moving. He helped her fasten it to the raft and run wires to the small rudder in the back. The raft was already fitted with a mast, so Leo and Calypso hauled their sail aboard and started on the rigging. They worked side by side in perfect harmony. Even among the Hephaestus campers, Leo had never worked with anyone as intuitive as this immortal gardener girl. In no time, they had the sail in place and all the supplies aboard. Leo hit the buttons on the Archimedes sphere, muttered a prayer to his dad, Hephaestus, and the celestial bronze console hummed to life. The rigging tightened. The sail turned. The raft began scraping against the sand, straining to reach the waves.
Go, Calypso said.
Leo turned. She was so close he couldn't stand it. She smelled like cinnamon and wood smoke, and he thought he'd never smell anything that good again.
The raft finally got here, he said.
Calypso snorted. Her eyes might have been red, but it was hard to tell in the moonlight.
You just noticed? But if it only shows up for guys you like... Don't push your luck, Leo Valdez, she said. I still hate you.
Okay.
And you are not coming back here, she insisted. So don't give me any empty promises.
How about a full promise, he said. Because I'm definitely...
She grabbed his face and pulled him into a kiss, which effectively shut him up.
For all his joking and flirting, Leo had never kissed a girl before.
Well, sisterly pecks on the cheek from Piper, but that didn't count. This was a real, full-contact kiss. If Leo had had gears and wires in his brain, they would have short-circuited.
Calypso pushed him away.
That didn't happen. Okay.
His voice sounded an octave higher than usual.
Get out of here. Okay.
She turned, wiping her eyes furiously, and stormed up the beach, the breeze tousling her hair. Leo wanted to call to her, but the sail caught the full force of the wind, and the raft cleared the beach. He struggled to align the guidance console. By the time Leo looked back, the island of Ogygia was a dark line on the distance, their campfire pulsing like a tiny orange heart. His lips still tingled from the kiss.
That didn't happen, he told himself. I can't be in love with an immortal girl. She definitely can't be in love with me. Not possible.
As his raft skimmed over the water, taking him back to the mortal world, he understood a line from the prophecy better. An oath to keep with a final breath. He understood how dangerous oaths could be, but Leo didn't care.
I'm coming back for you, Calypso, he said to the night wind. I swear it on the River Styx.
Chapter 53. Annabeth. Annabeth had never been scared of the dark, but normally the dark wasn't 40 feet tall. It didn't have black wings, a whip made out of stars, and a shadowy chariot pulled by vampire horses. Nyx was almost too much to take in. Looming over the chasm, she was a churning figure of ash and smoke, as big as the Athena Parthenos statue, but very much alive.
Her dress was void black, mixed with the colors of a space nebula, as if galaxies were being born in her bodice. Her face was hard to see, except for the pinpoints of her eyes, which shone like quasars. When her wings beat, waves of darkness rolled over the cliffs, making Annabeth feel heavy and sleepy, her eyesight dim. The goddess's chariot was made of the same material as Nico D'Angelo's sword, Stygian iron, pulled by two massive horses, all black except for their pointed silver fangs. The beast's legs floated in the abyss, turning from solid to smoke as they moved. The horses snarled and bared their fangs at Annabeth. The goddess lashed her whip, a thin streak of stars like diamond barbs, and the horses reared back.
"No, Shade," the goddess said. "Down, Shadow. These little prizes are not for you."
Percy eyed the horses as they nickered. He was still shrouded in death mist, so he looked like an out-of-focus corpse, which broke Annabeth's heart every time she saw him. It also must not have been very good camouflage, since Nyx could obviously see them. Annabeth couldn't read the expression on Percy's ghoulish face very well. Apparently, he didn't like whatever the horses were saying.
So you won't let them eat us?" he asked the goddess. "They really want to eat us."
Nyx's quasar eyes burned.
"Of course not. I would not let my horses eat you, any more than I would let Aklis kill you. Such fine prizes, I will kill myself."
Annabeth didn't feel particularly witty or courageous, but her instincts told her to take the initiative, or this would be a very short conversation.
"Oh, don't kill yourself," she cried. "We're not that scary."
The goddess lowered her whip.
"What? No, I didn't mean..."
"Well, I'd hope not." Annabeth looked at Percy and forced a laugh.
"We wouldn't want to scare her, would we?"
Percy said weakly.
"No, we wouldn't."
The vampire horses looked confused. They reared and snorted and knocked their dark heads together. Nyx pulled back on the reins.
"Do you know who I am?" she demanded.
"Well, you're Knight, I suppose," said Annabeth. "I mean, I can tell because you're dark and everything, though the brochure didn't say much about you."
Nyx's eyes winked out for a moment.
"What brochure?"
Annabeth patted her pockets.
"We had one, didn't we?"
Percy licked his lips.
"Uh-huh."
He was still watching the horses, his hand tight on his sword hilt, but he was smart enough to follow Annabeth's lead. Now, she just had to hope she wasn't making things worse. Though, honestly, she didn't see how things could be worse.
"Anyway," she said, "I guess the brochure didn't say much because you weren't spotlighted on the tour. We got to see the River Phlegethon, the Cocytus, the Arai, the Poison Glade of Aklis, even some random titans and giants. But Nyx, no, you weren't really featured."
"Featured? Spotlighted?"
"Yeah," Percy said, warming up to the idea. "We came down here for the Tartarus tour, like exotic destinations, you know? The underworld is overdone. Mount Olympus is a tourist trap."
"Gods, totally," Annabeth agreed. "So we booked the Tartarus excursion, but no one even mentioned we'd run into Nyx." "Huh, oh well, guess they didn't think you were important."
"Not important?"
Nyx cracked her whip. Her horses bucked and snapped their silvery fangs. Waves of darkness rolled out of the chasm, turning Annabeth's insides to jelly. But she couldn't show her fear. She pushed down Percy's sword arm, forcing him to lower his weapon. This was a goddess beyond anything they had ever faced. Nyx was older than any Olympian or Titan or giant, older even than Gia. She couldn't be defeated by two demigods, at least not two demigods using force. Annabeth made herself look at the goddess's massive dark face.
"Well, how many other demigods have come to see you on the tour?"
she asked innocently. Nyx's hand went slack on the reins.
"None. Not one. This is unacceptable."
Annabeth shrugged.
"Maybe it's because you haven't really done anything to get in the news. I mean, I can understand Tartarus being important. This whole place is named after him. Or if we could meet Day..."
"Oh, yeah," Percy chimed in. "Day? She would be impressive. I'd totally want to meet her. Maybe get her autograph."
"Day."
Nyx gripped the rail of her black chariot. The whole vehicle shuddered.
"You mean Hemera? She is my daughter. Night is much more powerful than day."
"Eh," said Annabeth. "I like the Arai, or even Aklis better."
"They are my children as well."
Percy stifled a yawn. "Got a lot of children, huh?"
"I am the mother of all terrors," Nyx cried. "The fates themselves, Hecate, old age, pain, sleep, death, and all of the curses. Behold how newsworthy I am."
Chapter 54. Annabeth.
Nyx lashed her whip again. The darkness congealed around her. On either side, an army of shadows appeared, more dark-winged Arai, which Annabeth was not thrilled to see. A withered crone who must have been Jairus, the goddess of old age, and a younger woman in a black toga, her eyes gleaming and her smile like a serial killer's. No doubt Eris, the goddess of strife. More kept appearing, dozens of demons and minor gods, each one the spawn of night. Annabeth wanted to run. She was facing a brood of horrors that could snap anyone's sanity. But if she ran, she would die. Next to her, Percy's breathing turned shallow. Even through his misty ghoul disguise, Annabeth could tell he was on the verge of panic. She had to stand her ground for both of them.
"I am a daughter of Athena," she thought. "I control my own mind."
She imagined a mental frame around what she was seeing. She told herself it was just a movie. A scary movie, sure, but it could not hurt her. She was in control.
"Yeah, not bad," she admitted. "I guess we could get one picture for the scrapbook, but I don't know. You guys are so dark. Even if I used a flash, I'm not sure it would come out."
Yeah, Percy managed. "You guys aren't photogenic."
"You miserable tourists," Nyx hissed. "How dare you not tremble before me? How dare you not whimper and beg for my autograph and a picture for your scrapbook? You want newsworthy? My son Hypnos once put Zeus to sleep. When Zeus pursued him across the earth, bent on vengeance, Hypnos hid in my palace for safety, and Zeus did not follow. Even the king of Olympus fears me."
"Uh-huh," Annabeth turned to Percy. "Well, it's getting late. We should probably get lunch at one of those restaurants the tour guide recommended. Then we can find the doors of death."
"Aha!"
Nyx cried in triumph. Her brood of shadows stirred and echoed.
"Aha! Aha!" "You wish to see the doors of death?"
Nyx asked.
"They lie at the very heart of Tartarus. Mortals such as you could never reach them, except through the halls of my palace, the Mansion of Night."
She gestured behind her. Floating in the abyss, maybe 300 feet below, was a doorway of black marble, leading into some sort of large room. Annabeth's heart pounded so strongly she felt it in her toes. That was the way forward, but it was so far down, an impossible jump. If they missed, they would fall into chaos and be scattered into nothingness. A final death with no do-over. Even if they could make the jump, the goddess of night and her most fearsome children stood in their way. With a jolt, Annabeth realized what needed to happen. Like everything she'd ever done, it was a long shot. In a way, that calmed her down. A crazy idea in the face of death?
Okay, her body seemed to say, relaxing. This is familiar territory.
She managed a bored sigh.
I suppose we could do one picture, but a group shot won't work. Nix, how about one of you with your favorite child? Which one is that?
The brood rustled. Dozens of horrible glowing eyes turned toward Nix. The goddess shifted uncomfortably, as if her chariot was heating up under her feet. Her shadow horses huffed and pawed at the void.
My favorite child? She asked. All my children are terrifying.
Percy snorted. Seriously? I've met the Fates. I've met Thanatos. They weren't so scary. You've got to have somebody in this crowd who's worse than that.
The darkest, Annabeth said. The most like you.
I am the darkest, hissed Eris. Wars and strife. I have caused all manner of death. I am darker still, snarled Jairus. I dim the eyes and addle the brain. Every mortal fears old age.
Yeah, yeah,
Annabeth said, trying to ignore her chattering teeth.
I'm not seeing enough dark. I mean, you're the children of night. Show me dark.
The horde of Arai wailed, flapping their leathery wings and stirring up clouds of blackness. Jairus spread her withered hands and dimmed the entire abyss. Eris breathed a shadowy spray of buckshot across the void.
I am the darkest, hissed one of the demons. No, I!
No, behold my darkness!
If 1,000 giant octopi had squirted ink at the same time at the bottom of the deepest, most sunless ocean trench, it could not have been blacker. Annabeth might as well have been blind. She gripped Percy's hand and steeled her nerves.
Wait!
Nix called, suddenly panicked.
I can't see anything!
Yes!
Shouted one of her children proudly.
I did that.
No, I did.
Fool, it was me.
Dozens of voices argued in the darkness. The horses whinnied in alarm.
Stop it, Nix yelled. Whose foot is that?
Eris is hitting me,
cried someone.
Mother, tell her to stop hitting me.
I did not, yelled Eris.
Ouch!
The sounds of scuffling got louder. If possible, the darkness became even deeper. Annabeth's eyes dilated so much, they felt like they were being pulled out of their sockets. She squeezed Percy's hand.
Ready?
For what?
After a pause, he grunted unhappily.
Poseidon's underpants, you can't be serious.
Somebody give me light,
Nick screamed.
Gah! I can't believe I just said that. It's a trick,
Eris yelled.
The demigods are escaping.
I've got them,
screamed an Arai.
No, that's my neck,
Jairus gagged.
Jump,
Annabeth told Percy. They leaped into the darkness, aiming for the doorway, far, far below. Chapter 55. Annabeth. After their fall into Tartarus, jumping 300 feet to the mansion of night should have felt quick. Instead, Annabeth's heart seemed to slow down. Between the beats, she had ample time to write her own obituary. Annabeth Chase, died age 17. Ba-boom. Assuming her birthday, July 12th, had passed while she was in Tartarus, but honestly, she had no idea. Ba-boom. Died of massive injuries while leaping like an idiot into the abyss of chaos and splattering on the entry hall floor of Nyx's mansion. Ba-boom. Survived by her father, stepmother, and two stepbrothers who barely knew her. Ba-boom. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to Camp Half-Blood, assuming Gia hasn't already destroyed it. Her feet hit solid floor. Pain shot up her legs, but she stumbled forward and broke into a run, hauling Percy after her. Above them in the dark, Nyx and her children scuffled and yelled,
"I've got them! My foot! Stop it!"
Annabeth kept running. She couldn't see anyway, so she closed her eyes. She used her other senses, listening for the echo of open spaces, feeling for cross breezes against her face, sniffing for any scent of danger, smoke or poison or the stench of demons. It wasn't the first time she'd plunged through darkness. She imagined she was back in the tunnels under Rome, searching out the Athena Parthenos. In retrospect, her journey to Arachne's cavern seemed like a trip to Disneyland. The squabbling sounds of Nyx's children got farther away. That was good. Percy was still running at her side, holding her hand. Also good. In the distance ahead of them, Annabeth began to hear a throbbing sound, like her own heartbeat echoing back, amplified so powerfully the floor vibrated underfoot. The sound filled her with dread, so she figured it must be the right way to go. She ran toward it. As the beat got louder, she smelled smoke and heard the flickering of torches on either side. She guessed there would be light, but a crawling sensation across her neck warned her it would be a mistake to open her eyes.
"Don't look," she told Percy.
"Wasn't planning on it," he said. "You can feel that, right? We're still in the mansion of night. I do not want to see it."
Smart boy, Annabeth thought. She used to tease Percy for being dumb, but in truth, his instincts were usually right on target. Whatever horrors lay in the mansion of night, they weren't meant for mortal eyes. Seeing them would be worse than staring at the face of Medusa. Better to run in darkness. The throbbing got louder still, sending vibrations straight up Annabeth's spine. It felt like someone was knocking on the bottom of the world, demanding to be let in. She sensed the walls opening up on either side of them. The air smelled fresher, or at least not quite as sulfurous. There was another sound, too, closer than the deep pulsing. The sound of flowing water. Annabeth's heart raced. She knew the exit was close. If they could make it out of the mansion of night, maybe they could leave the dark brood of demons behind. She began to run faster, which would have meant her death if Percy hadn't stopped her.
Chapter 56. Annabeth.
Annabeth!
Percy pulled her back just as her foot hit the edge of a drop-off. She almost pitched forward into who knew what, but Percy grabbed her and wrapped her in his arms.
"It's okay," he promised.
She pressed her face into his shirt and kept her eyes closed tight. She was trembling, but not just from fear. Percy's embrace was so warm and comforting. She wanted to stay there forever, safe and protected. But that wasn't reality. She couldn't afford to relax. She couldn't lean on Percy any more than she had to. He needed her, too.
Thanks.
She gently disentangled herself from his arms.
Can you tell what's in front of us?
Water, he said. I'm still not looking. I don't think it's safe yet.
Agreed.
I can sense a river, or maybe it's a moat. It's blocking our path, flowing left to right through a channel cut in the rock. The opposite side is about 20 feet away.
Annabeth mentally scolded herself. She'd heard the flowing water, but she had never considered she might be running headlong into it.
Is there a bridge, or...
I don't think so, Percy said. And there's something wrong with the water. Listen.
Annabeth concentrated. Within the roaring current, thousands of voices cried out, shrieking in agony, pleading for mercy.
Help! They groaned. It was an accident! The pain! The voices wailed. Make it stop!
Annabeth didn't need her eyes to imagine the river, a black, briny current filled with tortured souls being swept deeper and deeper into Tartarus.
The River Acheron, she guessed. The fifth river of the underworld.
I liked the Phlegathon better than this, Percy muttered.
It's the River of Pain, the ultimate punishment for the souls of the damned. Murderers especially.
Murderers, the river wailed. Yes, like you.
Join us, another voice whispered. You are no better than we are.
Annabeth's head was flooded with images of all the monsters she'd killed over the years.
That wasn't murder, she protested. I was defending myself.
The river changed course through her mind, showing her Zoe Nightshade, who had been slain on Mount Tamalpais because she'd come to rescue Annabeth from the Titans. She saw Nico's sister, Bianca D'Angelo, dying in the collapse of the metal giant Talos because she also had tried to save Annabeth. Michael Yu and Selena Beauregard, who had died in the Battle of Manhattan.
You could have prevented it,
the river told Annabeth.
You should have seen a better way.
Most painful of all, Luke Castellan. Annabeth remembered Luke's blood on her dagger after he'd sacrificed himself to stop Kronos from destroying Olympus.
His blood is on your hands, the river wailed. There should have been another way.
Annabeth had wrestled with the same thought many times. She tried to convince herself Luke's death wasn't her fault. Luke had chosen his fate. Still, she didn't know if his soul had found peace in the underworld, or if he'd been reborn, or if he'd been washed into Tartarus because of his crimes. He might be one of the tortured voices flowing past right now.
You murdered him, the river cried. Jump in and share his punishment.
Percy gripped her arm.
Don't listen.
But
I know.
His voice sounded as brittle as ice.
They're telling me the same stuff. I think this moat must be the border of Knight's territory. If we get across, we should be okay. We'll have to jump.
You said it was 20 feet.
Yeah, you'll have to trust me. Put your arms around my neck and hang on.
How can you possibly...
There, cried a voice behind them. Kill the ungrateful tourists.
The children of Nyx had found them. Annabeth wrapped her arms around Percy's neck.
Go!
With her eyes closed, she could only guess how he managed it. Maybe he used the force of the river somehow. Maybe he was just scared out of his mind and charged with adrenaline. Percy leaped with more strength than she would have thought possible. They sailed through the air as the river churned and wailed below them, splashing Annabeth's bare ankles with stinging brine. Then, clump! They were on solid ground again.
You can open your eyes, Percy said, breathing hard. But you won't like what you see.
Annabeth blinked. After the darkness of Nyx, even the dim red glow of Tartarus seemed blinding. Before them stretched a valley big enough to fit the San Francisco Bay. The booming noise came from the entire landscape, as if thunder were echoing from beneath the ground. Under poisonous clouds, the rolling terrain glistened purple with dark red and blue scar lines.
It looks like,
Annabeth fought down her revulsion,
like a giant heart.
The heart of Tartarus, Percy murmured.
The center of the valley was covered with a fine black fuzz of peppery dots. They were so far away, it took Annabeth a moment to realize she was looking at an army. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands of monsters gathered around a central pinpoint of darkness. It was too far to see any details, but Annabeth had no doubt what the pinpoint was. Even from the edge of the valley, Annabeth could feel its power tugging at her soul.
The doors of death.
Yeah.
Percy's voice was hoarse. He still had the pale, wasted complexion of a corpse, which meant he looked about as good as Annabeth felt. She realized she'd forgotten all about their pursuers.
What happened to Nyx?
She turned. Somehow they'd landed several hundred yards from the banks of Acheron, which flowed through a channel cut into black volcanic hills. Beyond that was nothing but darkness. No sign of anyone coming after them. Apparently, even the minions of night didn't like to cross the Acheron. She was about to ask Percy how he had jumped so far when she heard the skittering of a rock slide in the hills to their left. She drew her dragonbone sword. Percy raised Riptide. A patch of glowing white hair appeared over the ridge. Then, a familiar grinning face with pure silver eyes.
Bob?
Annabeth was so happy she actually jumped.
Oh my gods!
Friends!
The Titan lumbered toward them. The bristles of his broom had been burned off. His janitor's uniform was slashed with new claw marks, but he looked delighted. On his shoulder, Small Bob, the kitten, purred almost as loudly as the pulsing heart of Tartarus.
I found you!
Bob gathered them both in a rib-crushing hug.
You look like smoking dead people. That is good.
Ugh,
Percy said.
How did you get here? Through the Mansion of Night? No, no, Bob shook his head adamantly. That place is too scary. Another way, only good for titans and such.
Let me guess, Annabeth said. You went sideways.
Bob scratched his chin, evidently at a loss for words.
No, more diagonal.
Annabeth laughed. Here they were at the heart of Tartarus, facing an impossible army. She would take any comfort she could get. She was ridiculously glad to have Bob the Titan with them again. She kissed his immortal nose, which made him blink.
We stay together now?
He asked.
Yes, Annabeth agreed. Time to see if this death mist works.
And if it doesn't...
Percy stopped himself. There was no point in wondering about that. They were about to march into the middle of an enemy army. If they were spotted, they were dead. Despite that, Annabeth managed a smile. Their goal was in sight. They had a titan with a broom and a very loud kitten on their side. That had to count for something.
Doors of death, she said. Here we come.
Chapter 57. Jason. Jason wasn't sure what to hope for, storm or fire. As he waited for his daily audience with the Lord of the South Wind, he tried to decide which of the gods' personalities, Roman or Greek, was worse. But after 5 days in the palace, he was only certain about one thing. He and his crew were unlikely to get out of here alive. He leaned against the balcony rail. The air was so hot and dry, it sucked the moisture right out of his lungs. Over the last week, his skin had gotten darker. His hair had turned as white as corn silk. Whenever he glanced in the mirror, he was startled by the wild, empty look in his eyes, as if he'd gone blind wandering in the desert. 100 feet below, the bay glittered against a crescent of red sand beach. They were somewhere on the northern coast of Africa. That's as much as the wind spirits would tell him. The palace itself stretched out on either side of him, a honeycomb of halls and tunnels, balconies, colonnades, and cavernous rooms carved into the sandstone cliffs, all designed for the wind to blow through and make as much noise as possible. The constant pipe organ sounds reminded Jason of the floating lair of Aeolus back in Colorado, except here the winds seemed in no hurry, which was part of the problem. On their best days, the southern venti were slow and lazy. On their worst days, they were gusty and angry. They'd initially welcomed the Argo too, since any enemy of Boreas was a friend of the South Wind, but they seemed to have forgotten that the demigods were their guests. The venti had quickly lost interest in helping repair the ship. Their king's mood got worse every day. Down at the dock, Jason's friends were working on the Argo II. The main sail had been repaired, the rigging replaced. Now they were mending the oars. Without Leo, none of them knew how to repair the more complicated parts of the ship. Even with the help of Buford the Table and Festus, who was now permanently activated thanks to Piper's charm speak, and none of them understood that. But they kept trying. Hazel and Frank stood at the helm, tinkering with the controls. Piper relayed their commands to Coach Hedge, who was hanging over the side of the ship, banging out dents in the oars. Hedge was well suited for banging on things. They didn't seem to be making much progress, but considering what they'd been through, it was a miracle the ship was in one piece. Jason shivered when he thought about Keone's attack. He'd been rendered helpless, frozen solid not once but twice, while Leo was blasted into the sky and Piper was forced to save them all single-handedly. Thank the gods for Piper. She considered herself a failure for not having stopped the wind bomb from exploding, but the truth was, she'd saved the entire crew from becoming ice sculptures in Quebec. She'd also managed to direct the explosion of the icy sphere, so even though the ship had been pushed halfway across the Mediterranean, it had taken relatively minor damage. Down at the dock, Hedge yelled, "Try it now!" Hazel and Frank pulled some levers. The port oars went crazy, chopping up and down and doing the wave. Coach Hedge tried to dodge, but one smacked him in the rear and launched him into the air. He came down screaming and splashed into the bay. Jason sighed. At this rate, they'd never be able to sail, even if the southern venti allowed them to. Somewhere in the north, Reyna was flying toward Pyrrhus, assuming she'd gotten his note at Diocletian's palace. Leo was lost and in trouble. Percy and Annabeth? Well, best case scenario, they were still alive, making their way to the doors of death. Jason couldn't let them down. A rustling sound made him turn. Nico D'Angelo stood in the shadow of the nearest column. He'd shed his jacket. Now he just wore his black t-shirt and black jeans. His sword and the scepter of Diocletian hung on either side of his belt. Days in the hot sun hadn't tanned his skin. If anything, he looked paler. His dark hair fell over his eyes. His face was still gaunt, but he was definitely in better shape than when they'd left Croatia. He had regained enough weight not to look starved. His arms were surprisingly taut with muscles, as if he'd spent the past week sword fighting. For all Jason knew, he'd been slipping off to practice raising spirits with Diocletian's scepter, then sparring with them. After their expedition in Split, nothing would surprise him.
"Any word from the king?"
Nico asked. Jason shook his head. "Every day he calls for me later and later."
"We need to leave," Nico said.
"Soon."
Jason had been having the same feeling, but hearing Nico say it made him even edgier.
"You sense something?" "Percy is close to the doors," Nico said. "He'll need us if he's going to make it through alive."
Jason noticed that he didn't mention Annabeth. He decided not to bring that up.
"All right," Jason said, "but if we can't repair the ship..." "I promised I'd lead you to the House of Hades," Nico said. "One way or another, I will."
"You can't shadow travel with all of us, and it will take all of us to reach the doors of death." The orb at the end of Diocletian's scepter glowed purple. Over the past week, it seemed to have aligned itself to Nico D'Angelo's moods. Jason wasn't sure that was a good thing.
"Then you've got to convince the King of the South Wind to help."
Nico's voice seethed with anger.
"I didn't come all this way, suffer so many humiliations."
Jason had to make a conscious effort not to reach for his sword. Whenever Nico got angry, all of Jason's instincts screamed, "Danger!"
"Look, Nico," he said, "I'm here if you want to talk about, you know, what happened in Croatia. I get how difficult..."
"You don't get anything.
Nobody's going to judge you."
Nico's mouth twisted in a sneer.
"Really? That would be a first. I'm the son of Hades, Jason. I might as well be covered in blood or sewage the way people treat me. I don't belong anywhere. I'm not even from this century. But even that's not enough to set me apart. I've got to be... to be..."
"Dude, it's not like you've got a choice. It's just who you are."
"Just who I am."
The balcony trembled. Patterns shifted in the stone floor, like bones coming to the surface.
"Easy for you to say. You're everybody's golden boy, the son of Jupiter. The only person who ever accepted me was Bianca, and she died. I didn't choose any of this. My father, my feelings."
Jason tried to think of something to say. He wanted to be Nico's friend. He knew that was the only way to help, but Nico wasn't making it easy. He raised his hands in submission.
"Yeah, okay. But Nico, you do choose how to live your life. You want to trust somebody? Maybe take a risk that I'm really your friend and I'll accept you. It's better than hiding."
The floor cracked between them. The crevice hissed. The air around Nico shimmered with spectral light.
"Hiding?"
Nico's voice was deadly quiet. Jason's fingers itched to draw his sword. He'd met plenty of scary demigods, but he was starting to realize that Nico D'Angelo, as pale and gaunt as he looked, might be more than he could handle. Nevertheless, he held Nico's gaze.
"Yes, hiding. You've run away from both camps. You're so afraid you'll get rejected that you won't even try. Maybe it's time you come out of the shadows."
Just when the tension became unbearable, Nico dropped his eyes. The fissure closed in the balcony floor. The ghostly light faded.
"I'm going to honor my promise," Nico said, not much louder than a whisper. "I'll take you to Epirus,
I'll help you close the doors of death. Then that's it. I'm leaving. Forever.
Behind them, the doors of the throne room blasted open with a gust of scorching air. A disembodied voice said,
Lord Auster will see you now.
As much as he dreaded this meeting, Jason felt relieved. At the moment, arguing with a crazy wind god seemed safer than befriending an angry son of Hades. He turned to tell Nico goodbye, but Nico had disappeared, melting back into the darkness. Chapter 58. Jason. So it was a storm day. Auster, the Roman version of the South Wind, was holding court. The two previous days, Jason had dealt with notice. While the god's Greek version was fiery and quick to anger, at least he was quick. Auster, well, not so much. White and red marble columns lined the throne room. The rough sandstone floor smoked under Jason's shoes. Steam hung in the air, like the bathhouse back at Camp Jupiter. Except, bathhouses usually didn't have thunderstorms crackling across the ceiling, lighting the room in disorienting flashes. Southern venti swirled through the hall in clouds of red dust and superheated air. Jason was careful to stay away from them. On his first day here, he'd accidentally brushed his hand through one. He'd gotten so many blisters, his fingers looked like tentacles. At the end of the room was the strangest throne Jason had ever seen, made of equal parts fire and water. The dais was a bonfire. Flames and smoke curled up to form a seat. The back of the chair was a churning storm cloud. The armrests sizzled where moisture met fire. It didn't look very comfortable, but the god Auster lounged on it like he was ready for an easy afternoon of watching football. Standing up, he would have been about 10 feet tall. A crown of steam wreathed his shaggy white hair. His beard was made of clouds, constantly popping with lightning and raining down on the god's chest, soaking his sand-colored toga. Jason wondered if you could shave a thundercloud beard. He thought it might be annoying to rain on yourself all the time, but Auster didn't seem to care. He reminded Jason of a soggy Santa Claus, but more lazy than jolly.
So,
the god's voice rumbled like an oncoming front.
The son of Jupiter returns.
Auster made it sound like Jason was late. Jason was tempted to remind the stupid wind god that he had spent hours outside every day waiting to be called, but he just bowed. My lord, he said, have you received any news of my friend?
Friend?
Leo Valdez. Jason tried to stay patient. The one who was taken by the winds.
Oh, yes. Or rather, no. We have had no word. He was not taken by my winds. No doubt this was the work of Boreas or his spawn.
Yes. We knew that.
That is the only reason I took you in, of course.
Auster's eyebrows rose into his wreath of steam.
Boreas must be opposed. The north winds must be driven back.
Yes, my lord, but to oppose Boreas, we really need to get our ship out of the harbor.
Ship in the harbor.
The god leaned back and chuckled, rain pouring out of his beard.
You know the last time mortal ships came into my harbor? A king of Libya. Silos was his name. He blamed me for the scorching winds that burned his crops. Can you believe it?
Jason gritted his teeth. He'd learned that Auster couldn't be rushed. In his rainy form, he was sluggish and warm and random. And did you burn those crops, my lord?
Of course.
Auster smiled good-naturedly.
But what did Silos expect, planting crops at the edge of the Sahara?